Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West and West and all that other stuff that I say every time. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 330 of Registry Matters. Larry, how are you?
Doing very well, thank you.
Whoa, very well? What did we do to deserve a very well and not something of an old curmudgeon person that's 187?
Because my kitty cat is about to have more babies, so I'm looking forward to how many we get this time.
And this is exciting for you?
Of course.
Sounds terrifying to me. I'm not a cat fan. And that is not something that is not an unknown thing about me. I would never ever hurt one. They're hilarious to watch on YouTube. I would never ever have a cat. They're terrible creatures.
You just ran off the remainder of our audience. Thank you very much.
The three listeners that are still here in chat have now said adios. Chance, how are you, sir?
I love cats, man. I love cats, especially feral cats, which is what I think Larry's dealing with there. I'm good.
He is.
I'm good.
Why do you like feral cats then?
Yeah, they're wild. You know, they're unpredictable. And cats naturally are unpredictable, but feral cats, they're on steroids. Just ask Larry.
Actually, Larry, I have a question for you. Is Larry a Katmandu? That's a joke. I need a drum set. Ba-dumps. All right. Please head over and press like, subscribe. Do all of those things to help support the show and help share it out. Make sure, please, as a personal request, go to YouTube. You don't have to watch the video and go thumbs up it. And that would do well for us too. Or turn it on and then minimize the window and go about your business. And if you would like to become a patron and support us, then you could listen to us record this show live, where we actually have like a really large audience this week. It's slightly unusual. We usually have like a dozen or so, but we have 10 times that this week. And then you can be a part of our community. But lastly, the most important thing is subscribe to the podcast with your podcast app, and then you can listen to it while you're doing chores or driving to work. So, Larry, what are we doing this week?
Well, the great news, it's not just me, Mr. Gloom and Doom. Chance is with us tonight with the California Corner. And we also have a question from one of our supporters who's incarcerated. And the main event is a case from the Nebraska Supreme Court.
Now, how do you normally say that? Kowat?
The Nebraska Supreme Kowat.
How do you spell Kowat?
I'm not sure, but that's the way you pronounce it in the South.
And you were originally raised in the South, is that correct?
That's correct. So your Kowats are no good in the South.
I see. Pretty much anybody that's not from the South is no good in the South. All right. Well, this is a question from Michael. And he says, hey, Andy and Larry, and then I'll add Chance to the end of that. Happy New Year. Hope things are doing great with you both. I've just finished up the last full year I have to serve in prison. Wow, congrats. That's really awesome. So I'm doing great. I've got 2 weeks left in my four-month PFR program, after which I should be transferred to a release unit. 4 to 6 weeks later, I'll leave prison as a somewhat less unfree-than-usual man parolee. The registry, ankle monitor, treatment, the kabuki machine. Honestly, after Texas prison, it seems like a paradise. Seriously, even guys who have done time in Arizona, Louisiana, or Arkansas say that the TDCJ is like stepping back in time 50 years. I wanted to pick Larry's brain about something, since I know he has some experience in property management and leasing. God, somebody's actually reading like the between the lines when we talk about some of these things, Larry. Time after time, I've seen guys in prison at the cusp of release have to scramble to find a place to parole to. I myself have had one halfway house I was planning on paroling to, including paying an application fee and first month's rent, be forced to close by NIMBY, and that's N-I-M-B-Y types. And another has hit the maximum amount of registrants as allowed by the city. I'm thinking about purchasing some land in the rural or exurbs, and leasing out renovated single-wide trailers to returning citizens, including registrants. Do you know of anything in Chapter 62 of the Texas Criminal Code that would preclude me from acting as a private landlord. I know parole will likely nix associating with known felons, so I might have to wait until 2031, but after my list of probated employment, Article 62.063, only extends to bus drivers and carnival ride operators. Also, if I own a property but do not reside there, and I hate to use this example, but like Epstein had his ranch outside of Santa Fe, how do I not have to register that address as well? This is something I was considering investing in once I'm back on my feet to try to give back to the community. I'd like to sum up by wishing you guys a happy 2025. I'll contact you once I'm released in mid-March, I hope, to go back to the paper transcripts. Papal? Seriously? Papal? Or stop them altogether, if I'm allowed to use a computer. And as always, FYP. And that's sincerely Michael.
That was the one thing that AI messed up on the translation that I didn't catch. But I'm confident it meant paper, but AI is doing a really good job. I made maybe two or three corrections on this whole thing from what he had written.
From a handwritten letter, right?
From a handwritten letter, yes.
God, I love it. It's so amazing. It's so amazing.
Well, this is fun to do this one. The answer would be, to begin with, start saving your money, because it would be very unlikely that the supervising authorities in Texas would allow for you to have that type of business, particularly if you're going to cater to PFR types and known felons. But I do not know, nor have I ever heard of anything in Texas criminal code that would prohibit you from doing that. So once you're off paper, unless they pass laws really targeted towards you, I think you would be okay. But right now, this is the best way to find yourself under an intense scrutiny as you're being supervised. If you try to do this thing, folks, get a traditional job, be accountable, locatable, so that they can figure out where you are. There's only one person I know that's on the other end of this this podcast that's been able to work at home, do as he damn well pleased, and be able to pull this off for years and get early termination. But as a general rule, they frown on that. In terms of listing the address, I don't know of anything that requires, in any PFR registration statute anywhere, that requires you to list all properties you own. Maybe it's out there, but I'm not aware of it. But it requires you to list properties that you reside at least temporarily. But I don't know of that. Chance, have you ever heard of any obligation to list a property simply addressed because you own it and have an ownership interest in it?
No, I mean, in California, no. No. It's all about residential. It's all about where you live. All about residing. So you can own a bunch of stuff. If you don't reside there, or you don't reside there, you don't worry about it.
So, and to take that another step, I owned a rental property it's a good distance away, but I owned that. And I even off the record told my PO about it. And she was like, you don't have to tell me about that. And I was like, sweet. And I owned a rental property, had tenants, and I had property management. I registered in under an LLC, and I tried to keep it as far away of being first party related to me, so to speak, so that it was in a business bank account and so forth. And I had it all hands off.
Well,
that's the way to do it.
Had you purchased that property while you were under supervision here without telling them in advance, that would have been a violation, because all major financial transactions must be approved by your supervising probation officer. And they don't define
what constitutes a major.
Well, they don't define them, but I would assume that a house that cost $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 or $500,000 would qualify.
I would agree. But as a car, does that count?
Yes, a car counts. Anything that's going to incur a monthly obligation, because they want to make sure that you don't get over your head in debt.
Even though they're probably not the best of money managers themselves, would be a guess.
That would be my guess, but that's neither here nor there. I'm supervising you. You're not supervising me.
True. Another person in chat says he owns a second home and he's never registered that address.
I'm not aware of any state. Now, there was laws proposed because of Epstein here, but we fought that and it did not become law. The proposals to make that law, but that would be an unconstitutional infringement in my view. If I rent the property to you and I have to list it on the PR4 list, your rent, what you're willing to pay me as a regular tenant, is probably going to diminish dramatically if you have to deal with projectiles coming through.
Gotcha. Anything else here?
Nope. I hope we've answered it for him, and I hope he contacts us when he's out, because there are no more paper transcripts.
And I hope you, well, I mean, it's just around the corner, really, but I hope you do well, my friend, and good luck getting out in Texas. Pretty much anything is better than in prison, but that doesn't mean Texas is a good place to be either.
Well, Texas prisons are terrible, but it's bad. It's funny that he compared those states that are so bad to, say, Texas for 50 years, but I know it's bad. Yes. Over there.
I know you don't keep this like written down, but do you have sort of like a mental note of all the things, like all of the bullets that I dodged?
No, but it's a phenomenal number of things that you got away with.
Because I mean, like, I walked out and I went to the PO and I handed them a letter from the place that was going to employ me, and I said, I'm going to be a 1099. Here are the people that are going to employ me, and is it okay if they send me a computer? And he says, don't do anything you're not supposed to do. From day one.
Amazing, particularly in a very conservative part of the country where you were. Very amazing.
Yep. Okay, well then let's go over to this main event that you have, this case from Nebraska Supreme Court. Did I do that right?
Pretty close, yes.
Okay, I mean, I'm not a Southern. So, and it's Nebraska versus Clausen, which, God, I have a lot of ways I could say that one. And I've read it, and I'm completely exhausted. I had ChatGPT summarize it, translate it into multiple different languages. And I cannot comprehend why you are so giddy about it.
Well, simple. It's because we won, and we won on sufficiency of evidence, which is very rare.
Okay, well, I'm going to set it up. So Nebraska's PFR Registration Act, or SORA in this particular case, requires individuals subject to the act to register with authorities if they establish a new address, temporary domicile, or habitual living location. The state charged Chad R. Clausen with violating this requirement after an investigation revealed he had been intermittently staying at his fiancée's house without notifying authorities. So this has to do with how the days are counted, or is it more than just, like, is it the time that you put your head on a pillow? Is it the time that you cross the line of the state? All those things. Or is it more than that?
Oh, it's both, and maybe even more. But after a bench trial, the district court found Clausen guilty of violating SORA. The district court determined that Clausen had established a habitual living location and temporary domicile at his fiancée's house and had failed to register. Clausen appealed his conviction, arguing, among other things, that the state failed to prove that he established a habitual living location or temporary domicile, but the Nebraska Court of Appeals affirmed the conviction.
The opinion states, we granted Clausen's petition for further review. Now, this means that their review was discretionary. Do I have that right?
It does. That's what it means when they say they granted review. There are very few cases where you have an automatic appeal to the Supreme Court. There are some. Like in the state of Georgia. You've been there, right?
Yes, I've been to Georgia before.
Well, all capital death sentences are automatically appealed to the Georgia Supreme Court as a matter of right. But in most instances, it's a discretionary review. So in this case, they could have said, nothing to see here. We're going to let the Court of Appeals decision stand. But they didn't do that. They found enough interest and they granted review.
And then the court stated, because certain provisions of SORA are central to the issues presented in this case, we begin by reviewing them. Section 29-4004. Paragraph 3 provides that if an individual subject to SORA has a new address, temporary domicile, or habitual living location in a different county in this state, the individual must inform the sheriff of the county in which he or she resides within 3 working days before the address change. All right, that would be one point to mark right there. And the same subsection also requires such an individual to register with the county sheriff of his or her new address of residence within 3 working days after the address change. Now, that's confusing. Is it before or after the change one must register the address change?
Well, I was so confused by that. I went to the statute and it says what they say it says, which I expected that's what it would say because they are the Supreme Court. But I don't know. It's confusing to me as well.
But it's just to go off script for a second, but it says within 3 working days of address change. Wasn't this dude just like hanging out there?
But it says you also got to do it before. You got to do it before and after. Yeah. I don't understand how you can do both.
Hey, honey, I'll be over there in 3 days. But first, I have to go tell them I'm coming.
And you got to do that 3 days before. So,
right. Okay. And then the state initiated criminal proceedings against Clausen, alleging that he failed to comply with the registration requirements of subsection 2 or state statute 29-4004. After Clausen filed an unsuccessful motion to quash on the grounds that the terms habitual living location and temporary domicile were void for vagueness, the case was tried by the district court. Now, at trial, the state introduced evidence that Clausen had a prior PFR-type conviction that made him subject to SORA. The state also introduced evidence that during the time relevant to the case, Clausen was registered under SORA at an address in Douglas County, Nebraska. Do you want me to keep going there, or?
Yeah, that was supposed to be it. I guess.
That's fine. All right, so what is the difference between a habitual living location and a temporary domicile? God, we had the same sort of thing happening when we did the conference in Ohio.
Well, SORA provides definitions for both habitual living and temporary domicile. Habitual living location is defined as any place that an offender may stay for a period of more than 3 days, even though the PFR offender maintains a separate permanent address or temporary domicile. And then, that is already confusing to me, but a temporary domicile is defined as any place at which a person actually lives or stays for a period of at least 3 working days. So I guess the only difference is may stay versus actually stays or lives for a period of at least 3 working days. So the temporary domicile, you have to actually do it. But like I say, this is very confusing to me, and Chance is a Philadelphia lawyer. And do you find this confusing?
A little bit. It's a little confusing, yes. Mm-hmm.
It's about as clear as mud to me.
I agree. It's totally not clear.
All right. Well, most of the evidence introduced at trial focused on Clausen's presence at an address owned by his fiance in Washington County. Now, go back a couple paragraphs, and he lives in Douglas County. So here he is in Washington County. The state introduced evidence that law enforcement in Washington County began investigating Clausen in October of 2022 after receiving an anonymous tip that he was residing at a Washington County address. A law enforcement officer visited that address on October 18th and spoke with Virginia Guerrero, Clausen's fiance's mother. Guerrero testified that at the time the officer's visit, she and her daughter lived at the Washington County residence. When asked if Clausen was also living at the residence at the time of the officer's visit, Guerrero responded that he had been staying there for the past 3 to 4 months. Now, Guerrero later testified that Clausen had been living at the residence off and on. Now, sure seems like they had a good case if they have, like, a witness saying that he's living here.
I agree that his fiance's mother's testimony was not particularly good for him. But Chance, would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it seems pretty consistent. 3 to 4 months, living on and off, seems to be pretty consistent.
The state also called as a witness the law enforcement officer who spoke to Guerrero, and he testified that Guerrero told him Clausen had been residing at the Washington County residence for approximately 6 months. The district court ruled that it was receiving that testimony only for purposes of impeaching Guerrero's testimony. Now, Chance, would you please do me the favor of explaining what impeachment of testimony means?
Sure. In a general sense, impeachment of testimony refers to the process in a legal setting where one party challenges the credibility of a witness's testimony. That can involve showing that the witness is not truthful, that they have a bias, or that there was inconsistencies in their statements. For example, if a witness gives a statement that contradicts what they said previously, or if the evidence is presented that shows that the witness may have a motive to lie, their testimony can be impeached. It's really all about casting doubt on a witness's credibility in order to persuade a judge or a jury to question the accuracy of their account.
The officer also testified that later on October 18th, 2022, He spoke with Clausen by telephone. The officer testified that when he asked Clausen if he was living at the Washington County residence, and that Clausen responded that he was living out there for 3 days, and then he resides back at his residence in Douglas County for 3 days. The officer testified that he then confronted Clausen with the information Guerrero provided, and that Clausen then told him that he was staying at the Washington County residence most nights, after which Clausen apologized and asked if he was going to jail. Now, I think... Go ahead, Larry.
I think Clausen realized he was in trouble at that point.
Yeah, I'm guessing that he was found guilty of violating SORA by the district court.
Indeed. After trial, the district court entered a written order finding Clausen guilty of violating SORA's registration requirements. The district court found that the evidence showed that Clausen had established both a temporary domicile and a habitual living location in Washington County. The district court sentenced Clausen to 2 to 4 years imprisonment with credit for time already served. Now remember, in the land of enchantment here where I am, the maximum you can get for a first-time violation is 18 months. And it's not a serious, wow. It's not a serious violent felony, which allows you to reduce that day for day with good time. So if you behave yourself and participate in the program, you're going to do 9 months. That tells you the difference in the sentencing scheme. That's why we're viewed as being the soft on crime state. One example of why we're viewed that way.
And Clausen appealed that to the Court of Appeals?
He did. Clausen argued on appeal that there was insufficient evidence introduced at trial that he established a temporary domicile or habitual living location under SORA. Clausen also argued that the definitions of habitual living location and temporary domicile were unconstitutionally vague. I don't know where that... Who wrote this script?
I have someone that was having an aneurysm.
That's your question right there, where I've got my cursor.
Very well. All right. Well, do you agree with his assignments of error?
I do. And most importantly, the Nebraska Supreme Court agrees.
So the Court of Appeals rejected Clausen's sufficiency of the evidence challenge. The Court of Appeals noted that because the state did not dispute the interpretation of habitual living location and temporary domicile adopted by Doe, Supra? I don't know what this word means. Supra, like a Toyota Supra, a car?
What that means is...
I need explanation.
There was a citation that I didn't provide here. So when you use that term, that means that this case has already been cited. Chance can very clarify that. But you've got infra, supra, and this case means... if I get them confused. Which is supra? That means that preceding or post? Supra would be preceding. The Doe case was previously cited, which we didn't mention that. I cut that out.
There we go.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, then so I'll back up a little bit. The Court of Appeals noted that because the state did not dispute the interpretations of habitual living locations and temporary domicile adopted by Doe, the Court of Appeals would use those definitions. Now, can you explain why sufficiency of evidence claims fail so frequently, Larry?
Well, I'll explain it, and then Chance can help. It's because the evidence is viewed in light most favorable to the state. So you start with that premise. The appellate court is not sitting in the place of the trial court. They're not hearing this stuff live. They're not making value judgments on the reliability of witness and determine credibility. So you're starting an uphill climb that the light most favorable to the state. And then Clausen opened his mouth when he should have remained silent. Remember, he said that he talked to the detective. You remember that part? So he kind of goofed up that. But the Court of Appeals stated, as for the evidence, there is no evidence to indicate whether Clausen stayed at the Washington court residence on weekdays or weekends or both. However, it held that viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, a rational trier of fact could have found Clausen stayed at the Washington County residence for 3 consecutive weekdays or for more than 3 consecutive days. In the Court of Appeals view, Clausen's admission that he was staying at Washington County residence most nights permitted such a conclusion. Chance?
Right, right. Interpretation of evidence. It was there. There's got to be some evidence to look at, and that's where it led him. That's exactly where it led him.
May we look at the Nebraska Supreme Court's decision?
Yes.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say F-Y-P.
All right, well, what's the standard of review in the case then?
Well, it's a mixed standard. Statutory interpretation presents a question of law that the appellate court resolves independently of the trial court. And then they cite Bogue versus Gillis, and that's a 2022 case. And this is also known as a de novo review, which means that they're not bound by anything determined below. Sufficiency of the evidence is generally a losing argument. And they explain that the court stated in reviewing a criminal conviction for sufficiency of evidence, whether the evidence is direct, circumstantial, or a combination thereof, the standard is the same. An appellate court does not resolve conflicts in the evidence, pass on credibility of witnesses, or reweigh the evidence. Such matters are for the finder of fact. And then they cited a case that I can't pronounce. I think it's Haney, State versus Haney from 2024. The relevant question is whether, after viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the state prosecution, any rational trier of fact could have found the essential elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. So they had, this was a mixed, is a mixed standard of review. They're doing one de novo and they're doing one with heavy deference to the trial court.
Clausen argued that the Court of Appeals incorrectly interpreted the definition of temporary domicile set forth in State Statute 29-4001.01, paragraph 6. That subsection defines temporary domicile to mean any place at which the person actually lives or stays for a period of at least 3 working days. Now that's confusing.
Indeed it is. Clausen understands the Court of Appeals to have interpreted the language to mean any place at which a person subject to SORA actually lives or stays for any 3-day period. In support of this reading of the Court of Appeals opinion, Clausen pointed out that the Court of Appeals statement that it would be an absurd result and frustrate the purpose of SORA to allow a registered PFR to stay at a residence other than his registered one for 3 days out of every week, as long as those days are on a weekend. Now, you got to admit, he's got that. This is funny, but you're not going to admit it. So go ahead.
I am definitely not going to admit it funny. The Supreme Court stated, it's not completely clear to us how the Court of Appeals interpreted the language defining temporary domicile. On one hand, the Court of Appeals stated early in its sufficiency of evidence analysis that it would follow the definitions adopted in Doe. And in that case, the federal district court clearly interpreted, quote-unquote, working days to refer to Mondays through Fridays, with the exception of legal holidays. In addition, when explaining why it found there was sufficient evidence to find that Clausen established a temporary domicile, the Court of Appeals said that a reasonable trier of fact could find that Clausen stayed at the Washington County residence 3 consecutive weekdays.
But then they stated, on the other hand, however, the Court of Appeals appeared to later suggest that a temporary domicile should be interpreted to include places a person covered by SORA stays for any 3-day period, not just weekends, because it would be both an absurd result and frustrate the purpose of SORA to excuse such a person from registering just because the 3-day period included a Saturday, Sunday, or holiday.
Now, okay, so I almost should have the clip ready to play, but that sounds like purposivism to me.
It does to me as well. The Court of Appeals decided that they were going to look beyond the text and they were going to look at the purpose. And they said this would be inconsistent with the purpose, but that's exactly what it sounds like.
And the court stated, as always, statutory interpretation begins with the text. See Espinoza versus the text of SORA clearly requires persons covered by the statute to notify authorities if they establish a temporary domicile. And Sora specifically defines a temporary domicile. That definition, however, uses the phrase working days. Now, and without further definition. Now, when terms in a statute are not specifically defined, those terms are generally given their plain and ordinary meaning. Now, did they not reference the case of Doe versus Nebraska?
They did. That case was decided in federal court in the District of Nebraska in 2010. And Judge Koff is the one who did that. But in Doe versus Nebraska, the federal district court concluded that the term working days in the context of SORA would ordinarily be understood to refer to Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays, unless the day in question is a legal holiday. Several other courts have similarly concluded that the term working day days carries the same definition and of the ordinary meaning.
Now look, I have a personal example. I'm working with my kid and we're going through investing some small amounts of money, and it's the first of the month, so we went off and we did our little deposit. And it says the money should be deposited in 1 to 3 working days. That means it would be there possibly Monday, but Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday. It doesn't mean it's going to be there Saturday or Sunday, so working days means Monday through Friday, right?
Yeah, that's where we're headed with this.
Doesn't this get back to the absurd result of what the Court of Appeals cited?
Perhaps it does, or maybe it doesn't. The court stated, "We have recognized that doctrine allows the court to deviate from a statute's plain language if application of language would lead to a manifest absurdity." And they cited Parks versus Hy-Vee, which is a grocery company, and a case in 2020. The bar of manifest absurdity, however, is not easily cleared. That is a standard I've not heard of, manifest absurdity. We have said that a court may depart from statutory plain language on the absurd results doctrine only if the result is, quote, so absurd that the legislature could not possibly have intended it. And they cited Thomas versus Peterson, which is a 2020 case from Nebraska.
So on the one hand, they want to follow the law, the legal definitions of things, but only if it's too egregious that it doesn't make any sense to follow it. Is that what they're saying?
Not the way I'm reading it. They're saying that if the statute is so, if the interpretation is going to be a manifest absurdity, you can go beyond the plain text. But if it's not a manifest absurdity, that the text controls. So they are textualist, and they are consistently textualist. And this is an example of them being intellectually honest. They could have upheld the Court of Appeals, but they didn't.
The state stated, "We do not deny that one could make a policy argument that someone previously convicted of PFR-type crime should be required to inform authorities if he or she stays somewhere for any 3-day period. But the question, for purposes of the absurd results doctrine, is whether the legislature could have possibly intended to require registration only if a person covered by SORA stays somewhere for a period of 3 working days, as that term is ordinarily understood. Some line drawing by the legislature as to the duration a person subject to SORA should be able to stay at a location before requiring to be registered there is unavoidable. We are unable to say that the legislature could not have possibly intended to draw a line at 3 working days."
And you have to give them credit, as I do for this case. We had a case a few years ago of a person who was before the same Nebraska Supreme Court who had moved from Colorado. As an adjudicated juvenile, he was an adult by that time, and he got into a barroom brawl. And the law had changed in Nebraska in 2010 that said any person who has a registration obligation in another state has an obligation in Nebraska if they relocate there. And he said, but, you guys don't register adjudicated juveniles here. And they said, yeah, that's true, but you weren't adjudicated as a juvenile here. You were adjudicated in Colorado, and you did move here. You are a person, are you not? Well, yeah, I guess I am. You did have a sexual offense in Colorado as a juvenile. Well, yeah, I guess I did. Well, why are we here? You moved to Nebraska and got into a barroom brawl here, and we discovered you have that conviction. So therefore, you have to register. They could have easily flip-flopped here, but they kept to consistency. So although I'm not a textualist, I'm whatever it takes to win my case. If you're going to buy into the textualist doctrine, at least they were consistent.
So were there was there sufficient evidence according to the Nebraska Supreme Court?
No. They stated the evidence in this case did not allow for a proper inference based on circumstantial evidence. Compare this to the case often used hypothetical in which a person enters a building with a wet raincoat and a wet umbrella, and it's reasonably inferred that it was raining outside. But we fail to see, as neither has the state explained, how logic, experience, or common sense would allow one to infer that a person who has stayed at a location more nights than he had, more nights than not, had ever spent three consecutive weekdays there. Rather, one would have to engage in speculation to conclude that, because Clausen stayed at the Washington County residence most of the time, he must have stayed there three consecutive nights. Now, that's a good point. Yes, it's obvious to somebody who takes the most cynical view that if you stayed there, you likely stayed on weekends. But you don't have the evidence. And Chance, you can jump in here on this. The evidence just wasn't there for the trial court to make that determination. It was inferred, but the evidence wasn't there.
Well, yeah, it was inferred. And as I said before, it leads you to a conclusion, but you can't speculate. And I think that's the point here.
But they also stated, we acknowledge that there was also evidence that Clausen admitted that he was staying at the Washington County residence for 3 days and then staying at his address in Douglas County for 3 days. I'm just going to do some quick math. 3 + 3 = 6. So where was he the other day?
Well, we don't know.
We also acknowledge that if Clausen followed that exact pattern for several weeks, he would inevitably stay at the Washington County residence for 3 consecutive weekdays. But even if Clausen admitted to following such an exact pattern, there was no evidence as to the length of time he had been following such a pattern. And without such evidence, the trier of fact, again, would have had to engage in speculation to conclude that Clausen had stayed at the Washington County residence for 3 consecutive weekdays. Excuse me. We find that there was insufficient evidence that Clausen established a temporary domicile in Washington County. And then what was the ultimate outcome of this case?
Well, the conclusion states it best. The court stated, because the state failed to introduce sufficient evidence that Clausen established a temporary domicile or habitual living location in Washington County, it failed to prove that he violated SORA. Accordingly, we reverse his conviction and vacate his sentence. Too bad he's already served most of the sentence.
Oh, geez. Well, isn't that the irony of it then?
It is indeed, but
he goes out and fights it, that it takes that long for him to get the decision.
But at least it sends a message. Now, the Nebraska legislature is not going to let this stand. I would be very surprised if they didn't clean up the language this very session. But in the meantime, it addresses the point about clarity in drafting of legislation, which I'm big on. We've got to get it right, because otherwise you have these type of problems.
100%. Any parting words, comments, anything at all?
I think
Chance, Larry, anybody?
No.
Well, then I guess we will head over here and do this little section from the state that's on fire. Have they put out those fires yet, Chance?
Yeah, I think there's some still going, and it's terrible. Just my heart hurts over it. My heart hurts over it.
There are some YouTube channels that I follow that there are people that are like less than a mile away from where there are fire lines, and that's just amazing.
It's crazy. I'm smelling the fire in my living room now.
Oh, are you really?
Yeah.
I mean, that's awful.
Now, so it's spread quite a bit. Yeah, it's not a good situation.
Well, here we are back with another session of California Corner. And so we're going to go over the latest legal updates and discussion on significant issues in the Golden State. Today we have a fascinating case to dive into, and it's the People versus Christopher Hamilton. Joining me, as usual, is our legal expert, attorney Chance Oberstein. Now let's get right to it. Christopher Hamilton was convicted of federal felony possession of CP in 2009 and was required to register as a federal PFR. In 2022, a federal court terminated his registration obligation, but the California Attorney General notified him that he must register for life under California law as a Tier 3. Hamilton petitioned the Superior Court to terminate his state registration requirement. The The Superior Court denied his petition and Hamilton appealed. Chance, would you walk us through the procedural background of the case?
Absolutely. Here's a brief overview. On May 11th, 2009, Hamilton was convicted of felony possession of child pornography under federal law. He was sentenced to approximately 3 years in federal prison and released in 2012. Based on his conviction, he was required to register as a federal sex offender for 15 years. Now, we probably could stop right there, but let's keep on going. On May 20th, 2022, a federal district court terminated Hamilton's federal registration obligation after he had registered for 10 years. You know, kind of like on the lines of, along the lines of SORNA. On September 15th, 2022, the California Department of Justice notified Hamilton that his federal felony conviction required sex offender registration under California law. He was designated a Tier 3 offender requiring lifetime registration. On September 27, 2022, Hamilton petitioned the Superior Court to terminate or reduce his registration term under California law. The trial court denied his petition on March 20, 2023. He filed an amended motion in May of 2023, and that was also denied. He then filed a timely notice of appeal, which was in October of 2023, and the appeal was consolidated with another appeal filed in B333974.
Wow, that's quite a journey, Chance. What factors determine tier designation under Section 290 of California law?
And I think that's really essential here. Under Section 290, tier designation for sex offender registration is determined by several factors. First of all, the type of offense, which means the specific crime for which the individual was convicted. Two, risk assessment. For Tier 3 designation, the risk level can be determined by a static risk assessment instrument. Recidivism and prior convictions is number three, the individual's history of reoffending in any prior convictions. Number four, and this is the area that he was in right here, out of jurisdiction offenses, because in California, a federal offense is not a state offense. So the Attorney General assesses whether the out-of-state jurisdiction offense is equivalent to a California registrable offense. I'm having a little trouble saying that today, a little tongue-tied. Anyways, number five is custody exposure, the classification of an offense as a felony or misdemeanor, which depends on the potential or actual sentence. And this is really, really important because in California, a felony is a Tier 3 offense and a misdemeanor CP possession is a Tier 1 offense.
And in Hamilton's case, his federal felony conviction for possession of CP was deemed equivalent to a state felony case under Section 311.11, placing him in the Tier 3 status, which requires lifetime registration. The court upheld this interpretation and the Attorney General's classification, affirming the denial of Hamilton's petition to terminate his registration requirement.
Exactly right. And, you know, all he brought up other challenges, but all these constitutional challenges, such as equal protection and procedural due process, were easily dispensed with. Hamilton's federal felony conviction for possession of CP was assessed as equivalent to the state felony offense under Penal Code Section 311.11. Also, and most importantly in this scenario, the punishment Hamilton received reflects treatment as a felony offender for the state offense. Thus, Hamilton served a sentence equivalent to the state felony version of the same offense, because in California, misdemeanors are you can't do any more than a year on a misdemeanor. So he did three times that. I think this could have been determined in advance of his challenge by simply hiring an attorney familiar with these issues to write an opinion letter.
So the bottom line is, have a legal professional assess your chances of success before bringing your federal or out-of-state conviction to California if you want to save time and expenses.
Correct.
Is that about right?
That's exactly about right. And that's probably the most important thing, you know, you can learn from this scenario. That's the moral of the story. Before you invest all that time and energy and, you know, finance, you might want to consider at least getting an opinion before you roll the dice.
It's a coincidental chance that FYP and registry matters. We just received an email from an individual, and it seems like this might apply. It's from an individual named Marcus. It says, if I am no longer on the PFR registry in Iowa, and then I move to California, am I required to register in California?
Exactly. So the best thing to do for Marcus is to contact an attorney in California who can analyze his case and give him some probabilities as to whether he would or would not have to register in California.
Do you happen to know an attorney in California?
That would be me. Yep.
Whoa! That was weird how that got set up that way.
Yeah,
it was. And perhaps your telephone number could be put up on the screen while you speak for a moment?
Oh, sure. And if he has any questions, of course, he can contact me and we can set up a consultation and talk about this.
949-365-5842 is Mr. Chance's phone number. And you answer calls, correct?
I do. Funny you should say that, but, you know, I do.
I pretty much never answer the phone. This is a constant point of contention between me and Larry. But, all right. Well, we are at 45 minutes, gentlemen. Is there anything else that anybody would like to talk about before we head out?
I'd like to respond on this, Chance. I've not seen this case or the federal decision to remove him from the registry. But I am constantly griping about federal court overreach because they are inserting themselves. U.S. attorneys around the country are bringing cases that are questionably not grounded in a federal jurisdictional hook. I think this would be the flip side of that, and I might have to do a flip-flop on this because normally I don't like federal judges deciding things that they don't have jurisdiction to decide. I don't think the federal judge has any jurisdiction to grant relief from the registry because there is no federal registry for you to release anybody from. So I would sure like to see the order that granted him registration termination for a non-existent federal registry.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I mean, you know, you would note that SORNA, it puts these CP convictions on the lowest tier, which is tier one, which is 15 years. But if you show good conduct and behavior, you can knock off 5 years and get the 10-year treatment. So, yeah, it would be very interesting to see.
Well, I would possibly do a flip-flop on removing people from the registry. I might decide that they've got jurisdiction, but I don't know how they would have the jurisdiction because there's no federal registry. I don't know how they can, they would be trumping the state's responsibilities and their state's control. The states operate the registry, not the federal government. The federal government only entices the states to do this with funding. But if the feds don't, I mean, if the states don't want to register someone, or if they do want to register someone, the feds have no control over it. The feds only recommend the list. This list can be five times what the feds have on there if that's what a state wants. And they can leave off 10 offenses that the feds would like. They just don't get their funding. So I don't understand how they can terminate a registration obligation. I'd love to see that.
Yeah, interesting, huh?
So, all right.
Well, anything else? Cool. We good?
We're good.
We good.
All right. Well, I would like to thank the hundreds of people that are here in chat. And if you don't believe me, I could actually unmute all of them and they could all clap and then you could actually hear that it's hundreds that are here in chat listening to us. I thank y'all very much for coming out and supporting us. It's really very, very much appreciated, and it's very touching. I'm going to cry now. Just kidding. Head over to registrymatters.co for any for the show notes, and also FYP Education for blog posts and other things. And you can find us posting all kinds of YouTube videos now and other things. Leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. Email at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And please, for as little as a dollar a month, head over to patreon.com/registrymatters to support the work that we do here. I thank you very much, Chance, for bringing us the California corner, and of course, Larry, for the Nebraska case, and I will talk to you gentlemen in a week or so.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Have a good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.